tell you about is maybe a little bit different than the first two presentations, probably a little bit more similar to what you'll hear from Dr. Dudley, which is sort of a macroscopic view of a very complex program that evolved at the DC side. This is just our introduction, and I read the NCI guidelines carefully, and it said put the grant number in there, so I actually put it in there. Please note, Roland, I did that. This is a program that comes from the Center to Reduce Cancer Health Disparities. Okay, DC. This is what our institute is all about, bringing optimal cancer resources to all members of our urban community and being dedicated to eliminating cancer disparities. So that's why we got involved in patient navigation, because cancer disparities is a huge problem in Washington, D.C. D.C. is sort of the poster child, if you will. I call it a microcosm, and some of the economists call it a macrocosm. I didn't even know there was a macrocosm. But this is a national challenge, and D.C., unfortunately, is an acute microcosm of the problem. So we are actually a very small city with big city health challenges. There's only 550,000 people in D.C. proper, which is this diamond right here. Now, metropolitan D.C. includes everything out inside this beltway, and some people believe beyond as well. But of course, the Northern Virginia area is separated by the Potomac River, and the Maryland area is up here outside of the diamond, and then there's another river over here, the Anacostia River, and that will become important in just a second. D.C. is divided up into wards, and again, here is the Anacostia River, and you can see there are two wards that are south of the Anacostia River, what we call Southeast D.C. D.C., when it was laid out by the Founding Fathers and designed by the Frenchman L'Enfant, divided it into three quadrants: Northeast, Northwest, Southeast, Southwest. This is significant because these two wards here are in an area of Washington, D.C. that has an extraordinary lack of health care facilities. More than the wards, D.C. is also divided into neighborhoods, and these neighborhoods have definitive boundaries, and they have definitive cultures, and they have definitive conflicts and personalities of their own. So not only do we have to work inter-ward, but we have to work through this very complex network of neighborhoods. So this is a little bit about D.C., the highest per capita cancer mortality rates in the country. Now, to be perfectly honest, I think one needs to realize that that's an old-fashioned fraction problem. See, the denominator of the fraction is quite small, 550,000. The population is very heavily minority, and because of the increased cancer incidence among certain minorities, and particularly one of the numbers that really skews the whole situation for us is the incidence of prostate cancer in African-American males. When you divide that numerator over a small denominator, you come up with some really tragic rates if you think of us as a city. We have approximately 2,800 new cancer diagnoses and about 1,200 cancer deaths per year. It's the leading cause of death in the under 85 population in Washington, D.C. Here are the factors that affect us. Lack of a medical home, that is inadequate primary care. So there are a lot of folks in D.C. who don't have a doctor. I mean, we all oftentimes think, well, you know, who's your doctor? And so on, say, well, a lot of folks in D.C. don't have a primary doctor. So they don't have a medical home. We have screening difficulties, information deficit, a fragmented health insurance system, a very large proportion of uninsured and underinsured patients. 17% of blacks are uninsured, and 35% of Hispanics in D.C. are uninsured. Fairly high poverty rates, major cultural barriers, frequently related to fear and medical mistrust, and a labyrinthine healthcare system that is rivaled by none. Focusing in on breast cancer, Our project is actually specific to breast cancer. The large magnitude of disparities associated with breast cancer, but the reason that we chose breast cancer is that there was an infrastructure within all of the major medical institutions in D.C. That had a focused program in breast cancer. Many of the other institutions outside of my own did not have, and still do not have, programs that are specific to prostate or colorectal. So breast was really the only way that we were going to be able to bring all the players to the table that we needed to, and I'll get to that point in just a moment. Here are the actual statistics. About 600 DC women diagnosed per year, 120 die. Strikes white women more frequently than others, but black women are twice as likely to die in Washington, D.C. That's actually true nationally, but not quite as dramatic. We have data that have come from my own hospital's tumor registry documenting, and we've published several times. Be presenting at this at the AACR meeting in Atlanta on disparities, that black women and Latinas are presenting in our clinics at earlier ages with more aggressive disease. And that's stage for stage, but more importantly, grade for grade, which means there's some biology involved in it as well. Oftentimes, minority women with overt symptoms will not seek medical care. And so we have to be proactive to overcome those kind of barriers. Now, is this because there's a lack of medical care or a lack of screening? And if you do a macroscopic view, the answer to that is no. There's actually 11 hospitals, 4 major medical centers, and 3 cancer centers in Washington, D.C. Now, remember that 550,000 people, that's inside the diamond. Altogether, you know, metropolitan Washington is over 2.5 million, so it's a much larger catchment area. But we generally have reasonable screening rates. Our problem is that our resources are not evenly distributed. And just to give you an example of that, we have a total of 19 mammographic facilities in Washington, D.C. 5 are not open to the public. They're actually corporate. They're in, you know, government buildings and for employees only. So there's 14 that are open to the public. Of those 14, 13 are in Northwest, D.C. 1 is in Southeast, but that's a bit of a misnomer because there's about 3 blocks worth of Southeast D.C. that's north of the Anacostia River. It's in an area of Eastern Market right behind the Capitol building. So it's really not really Southeast D.C. It's in a highly gentrified, economically developing area. So what that means is that south of the Anacostia River, there's basically no mammographic facility whatsoever. And that's a huge problem. Okay, this is a boilerplate, so I am going to skip over this. I think most of this you have heard, I'm just going to skip over that. I'm going to just go over this quickly because at the end I'm going to show you another slide that gives sort of my cancer center's version of this framework. You saw this from Dr. Paschetta just a moment ago about this program defines patient navigation very narrowly. It begins at the point of abnormal finding and it ends at the point of conclusion of therapy, regardless of outcomes. So you have abnormal results, diagnosis, and treatment, and this is the box that this program specifically works within, and I think this was necessary. As you've already heard from the previous two speakers, even within this narrow box, there are so many different models of navigation that the box had to be narrowed in order to study navigation, but it's proving to be quite difficult because there's so many different forms. Again, a little bit of a boilerplate, but it affects our site directly. Main hypotheses that patient navigation will reduce and eliminate access barriers, improve timeliness and quality of diagnosis, and improve satisfaction with the healthcare system experience. And other questions are, what is the impact of the type of navigator, and does race, ethnicity, or language matching of patients and navigator improve outcome? Those two were important for us because when we started this program in 2004, we faced a difficult challenge. And most of you know that Washington, D.C. is a highly politically charged atmosphere. It's actually very difficult to work here in the healthcare arena, because you're always looking over your shoulder on the implications of what you do and how it's being interpreted, because if you're not careful, you find yourself above the fold in the Washington Post the next morning, and then you're in deep doo-doo, okay? Then you don't want that. So we were very concerned at that point in time in offering patient navigation as a service in some centers and not offering it in others in order to establish a control group, because we were very concerned, and I'm being very frank here, that someone who wanted to be critical could turn that around, turn it on its head, and say, what do you mean? You're actually denying offering a service to a particular group of women in a particular area. That's not right. So we originally came up with a design where we separated two different levels of navigation. We came up with the term enhanced navigation and standard concrete navigation. Now, standard concrete navigation was defined as overcoming what we call concrete systems barriers. These are some of the things you've already heard: transportation, scheduling, appointments, phone calls, and things like that. And then we tried to define enhanced navigation as going further to include culturally and linguistically matched psychosocial counseling. And so what we were going to compare, what we were going to say is all patients were going to get navigation. All patients were going to get at a minimum standard concrete navigation. And then we would randomize patients into an arm that also, over and above that, got enhanced navigation, and we would compare those two levels. Well, we really tried to maintain that, as Dr. Garcia can tell you, for a while, but we gradually got, we had to succumb to circumstances that developed outside of our control. There's also a cost-effectiveness part to this. I'm not going to dwell on that today. And then we were going to analyze assessment factors that mediate intervention effects, like coping styles, perception of healthcare providers, attitudes, fatalism, etc., and things like that. So the question is, what happened to advanced navigation? Well, it has gone away for us because of success. Not our success, but success of patient navigation in general. The concept of patient navigation has swept the country, unlike any other new introduction to the healthcare arena that I've ever seen. And because of that, often high-level navigation is now routine standard of care in many, many places. This directly affected us. My own hospital, the Washington Hospital Center, which is another hospital in D.C., and Howard University, routinely offer what we used to call enhanced navigation as standard of care. And this is a dramatic departure from what was occurring in 2004, where GW was actually the only site of all three of those that were offering any navigation whatsoever. So there's, and the other problem that we face in D.C. is that there are lots of demonstration projects. Every group in the country that wants to do something in patient navigation comes to Washington to do a demonstration project, and that becomes a problem for identifying uncontaminated controls. So what we ended up doing is consolidating navigation into one arm. We did add two different controls, a concurrent control, which we've called D.C. Usual Care. And this evolved because we've been able to work with the D.C. Department of Health and identify women who are on a government safety net. And what we do is we track women who are not finding their way to one of our navigation sites. So, and we call that a usual care control. And then the other thing we've done is add historical controls, which are available at four sites, mining hospital tumor registry data. So this is what we're trying to do now. We're trying to determine whether navigation decreases the time between suspicious finding to diagnostic resolution, decreasing the time between diagnosis to treatment, and analyzing cost effectiveness. This is what went on in the first year. Because of the politics of D.C., it was very, very important for us to develop a community advisory panel, a program advisory group. We have people from every walk of life represented on these panels, so that we can turn to them and gain their endorsement. And by getting their endorsement, it gets us access into communities that we would not otherwise have access into. These are our recruitment intake sites where we're enrolling women. at the GW Cancer Institute in affiliation with our medical faculty associates. That's our breast care center. The Capital Breast Care Center is affiliated with the Lombardi Cancer Center at Georgetown University, but it's actually in southeast D.C. That's the site I mentioned to you that's in southeast but north of the Anacostia River. It's actually a storefront mammography center. Howard University Cancer Center, there's a large hospital center in the northeast quadrant of D.C. called the Washington Hospital Center, and there's two sites there, the Elmer Huerta's Preventorium that focuses on Latinas, and a breast care center, which has a very a mixed population. Nueva Vida is a community group that sees a lot of Latinas, almost no matter whether they've been to a hospital and had mammography elsewhere or first. We found that no matter what way women enter the system, they find their way to Nueva Vida. So it's a community group that's now functioning as a recruitment intake center because they see so many of the Latinas in D.C. We just brought Providence Hospital online, and D.C. AHEC at Greater Southeast Community Hospital was also part of the group. At my side, it's myself, Paul Levine, Lisa Alexander, Nancy Laverta is sitting in the front over here, and two research coordinators, and these are the PIs of the subcontracts at the site. Some of you may recognize Jeannie Mandelblatt, Carla Williams, Elmer Huerta, Sandy Swain, Larissa Caicedo, and William Funderbunk, and Kim Bell. These are the navigators themselves, and I just show this to say we have navigators that are nurse PAs, all the way down to completely lay navigators. So we, even in the DC site, we have a broad spectrum of navigators, but they all work together, and we have created this unprecedented network of navigators that are all working together. They're connected by email. They help enroll each other's patients. If a woman gets seen at the Capital Breast Care Clinic and they have their mammography there, that patient will then be navigated either to GW or Howard or Washington Hospital Center, where a navigator at that site will pick them up. So we now have a network of 11 navigators all through the city, and that's why our particular program is called the DC Citywide Patient Navigator Research Program. So we have created a citywide network that tracks patients at that level. Okay. These are some of the challenges. This is the last thing here. Difficulty in coordinating such a complex citywide network. Different IRBs with different requirements, different expectations, and different levels of risk avoidance. Having to manage all of those takes an enormous amount of time and effort. Different standard operating practices at each site. Lower than expected consenting rate because of too many questionnaires, too much time, patients who are too busy. We'll get the service anyway, many demonstration projects, and defining navigator boundaries, getting physician buy-in, which you've heard from before. So I'll end here. This is our framework of our cancer center. We sort of view patient navigation as a little bit broader than starting here and ending here. We think of it, we actually call our screening navigation. We find that the same barriers that affect women once they're in the medical care system are barriers that affect getting them to the medical care system, getting them into screening. So screening navigation is connected with outreach education and, of course, the actual event of screening, then through abnormal diagnosis, and then all the way through survivorship, tracking these women after their treatment is concluded. The one thing I wanted to tell you, just so I don't leave you thinking that there's still a quadrant of the city that has doesn't have any access, we operate the only mobile mammography program in the Middle Atlantic region of the states, and that's it up in the corner there. It's called the GW Mammovan. We launched the newest Mammovan. The whole program has been active since 1995. But in 2005, we bought a new van, outfitted it with digital mammography, and that van provides about 2,500 mammograms per year to the medically underserved women through our region, including in that quadrant of southeast D.C. And that van actually has a bilingual patient navigator on it.